And please help me to welcome our speaker tonight, Sarah from the Port Fishington Speaker Group.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
I want to thank the group for having me up to speak tonight. And I'll just start off by saying I have a sobriety date. It is May 3rd, 2012. I have a home group. It's the Port Fishington Speaker Meeting. We meet on Monday nights at 7:30. And it's an hour speaker meeting just like this. I have an amazing sponsor, and I have the absolute honor and privilege of sponsoring Women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always see it. Like, I first started sponsoring women when I came to AA because I was told I had to because I was going to drink again. And what has happened as I've had an experience with the 12 steps and practiced these principles in my life, it's become one of the greatest joys that I get to experience in this program. I get to see women's, you know, lives be made new again and reconnect with their families and watch God show up in their lives. And it's an absolute honor and privilege because I'm that alcoholic that, you know, brought nothing to this world. I was a low bottom, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. And there was never a period of time where I got to actively witness God in such a way. So it's such a beautiful part of my life. And I just have a simple job tonight. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened and what it's like today. I was brought up in a really good family, actually. I had both parents. They're still married today, 52 years later. I was loved and I was provided for. I had 6 brothers and sisters growing up. And, you know, before I had an experience with the 12 steps, I would have told you that nobody cared about me. Nobody loved me, that my parents didn't, you know, treat me right, that my mom was abusive and all these other things. And none of that's really true. I just have this this skewed perception of reality, right? And from as far back as I can remember, I just remember not feeling okay in my own skin. I remember feeling different and disconnected and afraid all the time. And all I ever wanted to do was fit in. I wanted people to like and accept me. And I didn't care what I had to do to get you to like and accept me. That means I became dishonest at a very early age. You know, I thought if I could make myself into something that you wanted me to be, you know, that would make me okay inside. I was always seeking to fix something that was wrong inside with a solution that was outside of me. And I just could never find that. But I really did. I had a decent upbringing. I had strict parents. My father was a Presbyterian minister, so God was the center of our household. We were that family that prayed around the table. In fact, sometimes we did it in public. So the whole idea of God and the concept of God that I grew up with caused me a lot of shame and embarrassment. I was embarrassed of my parents' faith. And I was embarrassed of the fact that my father was a minister, and I was embarrassed of the fact that we were poor. And I was uncomfortable with the fact that because of my father's job, I was always the new kid in school. You know, my father's job took us from state to state. So on top of already feeling uncomfortable in my own skin, I always have to try to fit in a new surrounding. And I look different and I sound different. And I just can't seem to fit in wherever I go. And I, of course, blame my parents for this. And I blame my, you know, like, this is their fault. They're doing this specifically to me. You know, I forget the fact that they have 6 other children. It's like they're doing this to me. And that's constantly how I felt, like this, lived in this victim state for as long as I can remember. And that was made a lot worse when I was 15 years old. And for a really long time, I thought what happened when I was 15 is the reason I was an alcoholic. And I know today that that's not the truth, but it is kind of what set my drinking career in motion. When I was 15 years old, I experienced a terrible trauma at the hands of 3 men who was beaten severely, brought to the hospital. And my mother was called to the hospital. And when she got there, her reaction was one of guilt and shame, kind of, how could you let this happen? And it was after that happened, and my mother's reaction to that, I just wanted to die. That discomfort and that pain of being me that already existed was just made a million times worse. And I just wanted to die, and I hated everybody around me, especially my mother and the men who did this to me. And before this trauma, like, I had had alcohol, you know, I had a drink here and there, but it was after this happened that I really realized the effect that alcohol could produce for me. Like, it took everything away. It made everything okay. It made me able to talk to you. It made me comfortable in my own skin. I was able to, I felt free. I felt like I could breathe for the first time in my life. And I stopped wanting to kill myself. So effectively, alcohol saved my life. It was my solution, and it worked for a really long time until it stopped working. I don't know. I drank alcoholically, like, from very early on, like from a teenager, like a blackout drunk, you know, getting dropped off on my mom's front doorstep by friends and, you know, disappearing for weeks at a time. My parents never knew where I was. I tortured these people. you know, I can't even imagine, because I have children today, and I can't even imagine not knowing where my child was, as a, you know, even now, and she's an adult, but as if not knowing where she was at 15 years old, and this is the hell I put them through, and I didn't care. My selfishness and self-centeredness doesn't allow me to care about these types of things. And my parents did everything they knew they could to try to help me, you know, psychiatry, therapy, they sent me to group homes, and I just fought them tooth and nail on everything, because you were just separating me from my solution when you did that. Anyway, when I was about 18 years old, I met a guy who I wasn't physically afraid of, and he became my first boyfriend. And, you know, about a year later, I ended up pregnant, and what you do in when you grow up in a family like mine and you get pregnant out of wedlock is you get married. And I'll tell you, I wasn't really opposed to this idea, because I knew that if I married this guy, he would pay all my bills and he would take care of everything. And that's kind of what I was looking for. Like, I don't like taking care of myself. I'm irresponsible and I'm lazy. And I also believed this, and I believed this for a really long time. I had this delusion that if I dressed up the outside in a certain way, that would make what was wrong with me inside okay. Like, if I had the right house, the right husband, the right number of children, the right job, the right car, I would be just like everybody else and I would be okay. And I chased that delusion in a lot of things, in marriages and in jobs and bringing children into this world. But, you know, no human power can relieve my alcoholism, right? And this man was my first victim. And that marriage lasted about 10 months. And I'll tell you, like, even up until like 2 years ago, well into my sobriety, I was telling the story that the reason that marriage ended was because he got violent and he beat me up and all this other stuff. And it's one of those things where I'd been telling a lie for so long that I started to believe it. And I was believing it even into sobriety, you know. But the longer I stay sober, the more clarity I get, the more truth I get to see about who I am and my story. And the reality is there was a violent altercation last night because I, like, freaked out and assaulted him, and he had to restrain me. And I called 911 and took everything from him. I took his apartment, his car, his kid, his money, everything. And I lived off his dime for about 3 years, you know. And I was always able to kind of keep dress up the outside. You know, I had managed to stay sober during my pregnancy with my daughter, and I had periods of sobriety where I was able to stay sober because my disease hadn't progressed to that point. And even our literature talks about, like, there are those times that we can, you know, if there's a sufficient enough reason for us to not drink, you know, we fall in love, a job, whatever it is. And for a period of time, I was able to do that early on. So there was no way I was going to believe I was an alcoholic. But there are these things that I see in hindsight. I look back, like during the pregnancy with my daughters, like I stayed dry the entire time, except the whole 9 months I'm sitting there counting the seconds, like, wait, I cannot wait till this baby is out of me so I can go to the bar. And I know today that that's not how normal people think. Like my sister, like she gets pregnant and she just carries a baby and she's not stressing about when she's going to be able to drink again. But I was already an abnormal drinker at that point. And I don't know, like I was able to kind of put this show on the outside and dress up the outside and take care of my daughter and show up at a job. And I always kept the roof over my head, or at least my ex-husband did. And, you know, that convinced me that there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. And there was a lot of unmanageability, although I couldn't see it. Like, because I always had the roof over my head, but it was always a different roof. You know, I always had a job, but it was always a different job. You know, it talks about in the bedevilments, we're unable to make a living. Not because I can't work, but because I always screw up or do something, or I'm lazy, or I don't show up. And I get fired. And that's what kept on happening. And when my daughter was 3 years old, I couldn't financially, like, even with the money my husband was giving me, I couldn't provide for my child anymore. So I went to him to basically extort more money out of him, and he cut me off, and he's like, I'm done. And he's like, I'm taking you to court. And he did. And he took primary physical custody of our child. And again, like, I threw this huge scene. It was like, victim, you're taking my kid from me. How could you? And this is the worst thing that ever happened to me. How dare you? She's my child. I gave birth to her. And in reality, when my daughter wasn't with me, I could drink the way I wanted to drink. It was almost a relief to not have to be a full-time parent anymore. My daughter was in the way of my drinking. My children were in the way of my drinking, and that's the truth. And when my daughter was with him, I could go to the bar all the time. I could drink around the clock. I could move where I wanted to move, and alcohol had started to dictate everything I did. It dictated where I lived. I moved to Manhattan because the bars closed at 5 a.m. versus 2 a.m. Like, I worked in the restaurant business because I could drink around the clock. Like, I made decisions for my life based around alcohol. And you know, I didn't have to be a full-time mom. I didn't have to be responsible, and I didn't have to take care of another human being. And that was okay with me. But I still kept, you know, playing this sob story for everybody. Like, I can't believe I can't be with my daughter. Meanwhile, I'm out partying every night. And this went on for a few more years. And when I was about 27 years old, I met the love of my life in a bar. And, you know, we meet one night, and then 2 weeks later, we're signing a lease together. And a month later, he's pulling out a big diamond ring. And I'm thinking, this is it. I'm going to be okay now. This is the marriage that's going to fix me, because I actually love this guy. Like, the other guy, not so much. This guy, I want to be, like, everything. He's perfect, right? I know him for a solid month and a half, and he's perfect. And here's the other problem. He knows nothing about me, like, literally nothing, not what I do for a living. Everything was a lie. You know, I told him I was an executive assistant, and I was a receptionist, and we lived under the same roof. Like, there wasn't an honest word that came out of my mouth, and he didn't know that I hadn't breathed a sober breath from the day I met him. He just didn't know. And he didn't know I wasn't sober when we took our vows on the beach in Jamaica about 6 months later. And he didn't know 6 months after that, when I got pregnant, that I wasn't sober. And this was it. Like, I thought we were going to have the perfect little family, except I'm so crazy and delusional. Like, I'm not even sober trying to carry this child. And I start to have these problems with the pregnancy a couple months in. And I go to the hospital, and the hospital makes this mistake. And they owned it. Like, they said, they admitted they made a mistake. They gave me this medication they weren't supposed to. And it basically terminated the pregnancy in a terrible way. And this was kind of a real turning point, my alcoholism, because I remember coming home from the hospital, and I remember sitting in the living room of our apartment, and my husband's pacing the room, and he's freaking out. He's going to sue this doctor. He's going to sue this hospital. And he's so angry, and I'm terrified. I'm absolutely crippled with fear. This man's going to leave. He wants a baby. I have to fix this. That's all I could think, is how can I fix this? What can I do to fix this? And the brilliant idea that comes to my mind is, I'll get pregnant again. And I do. And things got really dark during that pregnancy, because I didn't have an attachment at all to this child inside of me. I didn't want to be pregnant. I had only gotten pregnant to try to fix something. And I knew I wasn't able to carry this child, and I didn't want to. And I was so full of shame about that, and I was so embarrassed. And I knew that I couldn't tell another living soul, because what kind of woman doesn't want the child living inside her? What kind of monster am I? And I can't breathe a sober breath the entire pregnancy. I stop eating. I end up in the psych ward twice. And he starts to see, for the first time, who he actually married. He sees the truth. And it's ugly. It's ugly. And as a direct result of all my actions, my son is born. He's 3 months premature, and he's 2 pounds. And the first time I lay eyes on him is in an NICU, and he's in an incubator, and he's got tubes all over him. He can't breathe on his own. And I look at my son, and I fall in love with him, because I know he's mine, and that all that connection that was missing during the pregnancy, all was there the second I laid eyes on him, except I put him there, and I knew I put him there. And the guilt and shame was so overwhelming that I couldn't take it. It was so heavy, I couldn't even breathe. And I went to the only solution I knew of at the time, which was my alcohol, and it just wasn't working the way it used to work. That sense of ease and comfort that I used to get with one drink, two drinks, it wasn't happening. I just needed more and more, and I wasn't getting the relief. My head didn't stop. It just wouldn't stop. It was always telling me, like, you don't deserve to even live anymore. And I tried. I wanted to be a mother to this little boy so badly. I wanted to be a wife to this man. I really did. Our book talks about it. We had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we want to. And I wanted to. I wanted to take care of this little boy, and I couldn't. I kept dropping him on the floor, and I would leave him in the car to go drink. Like, that's the kind of mother I was. And when he was 8 months old, my husband got a phone call from the police station saying, you need to come pick up your son. We're taking your wife to jail. And that was it. Like, he had enough. He packed up everything. He packed up our child, and he left. He left to protect his son. And I came home to this empty apartment. My daughter wasn't really in my life that much at that point, because her father started to see the train wreck that I was becoming, and it was just me alone in this empty apartment, and I wanted to die, but I didn't have the courage to kill myself. So I just lay in bed and I stopped eating and I started drinking around the clock. Like, that's it. As much as I could get in my system, that's what I was doing. And this went on for almost 2 months. And my mother, this woman, by the way, who I've demonized for everything, like in my entire life, and blamed her for everything that ever went wrong in my life. She has a gut feeling that something's wrong with her child, and she gets in her car and drives from Baltimore to Delaware County in a two-hour drive, shows up at my door, and I'm 75 pounds, and I have a fever of 106, and I can't walk, and I'm swollen everywhere, and I'm taken to the ICU with a heart infection, blood infections all over my body. And they tell my mother she's going to die, and there's nothing we can do. And I'm sitting there screaming at this woman who's doing nothing but standing at my bedside trying to be helpful, saying, how could you do this to me? Why didn't you just let me die? And that's my selfishness and self-centeredness. Like, I'm asking a mother why she wouldn't let her own child die. Like, I have children, and I can't even imagine that pain. But I don't care, because I just want my suffering to stop. I don't care about anybody else's suffering. I always thought that my disease wasn't hurting anybody but me. And I used to say that all the time. My drinking doesn't hurt anybody but me. And oh my God, looking back at the wreckage that I caused, what a lie that was. What it was one of the greatest lies I ever told myself. I obviously didn't die. I spent a month in the ICU and 5 months in a skilled nursing facility, which is like a nursing home, and I had to have physical therapy to walk and all this good stuff. And the sickest part of that is I can't stop drinking in there. I just found other ways to drink. I had a surgical port put in my chest. And that's, I just couldn't stop. And frankly, I didn't have the desire to stop. And that was my story for a long time, you know, and thank God for AA and thank God for the traditions. And I love the tradition that the only requirement is for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And if you're here, you know, and that's all you have is a desire, well, welcome. And if you're here and you're not even sure you have the desire, well, welcome, because years I spent coming in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even have the desire. I had the desire for the consequences to stop. That's it. The idea of being in my sober skin was so unbearable, I didn't have the desire to stop living that life. I just wanted to find a way to successfully control my drinking so I could drink without the consequences in it. And I thought I'd find that in the rooms of AA, and I found something so much greater. I got out of the hospital, still no desire to stop, so I didn't. And I just bounced around from place to place and, you know, sick relationship to sick relationship, and detox started hitting up, you know, the nice detoxes in the beginning, and then, you know, the not so nice ones, and then prison cells. And every time I hit the detox or the rehab, I met the love of my life in group, and we ended up leaving together and becoming co-defendants. I would get separated from alcohol over and over and over again. Like, every time I end up in these places, I'm as sober as I'm ever going to be. You know, I end up in jail, I'm sober, dry. And I end up in detox, dry, I'm separated, and I'm like, that's it, I'm done, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna be a good mother. I'm gonna get it together, I'm gonna be a drug and alcohol counselor, I'm gonna help everybody, and every time you open the doors, I drink. And I can't figure out why. And maybe I can get 30 days sober once I'm out, but that's it. That's it. And I don't know why. I don't know why my thoughts always go back to a drink, no matter what I do. Because I didn't know what I suffered from. And this was going on for like 6 years until I actually ended up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't come to the rooms of AA because I liked what was going on here, or because, like, you know, you guys, you know, I was attracted to the rooms. I was paroled here, essentially. I was paroled to a halfway house, and a requirement for being, I had to spend 90 days there, and a requirement for being there was that you had to, you know, attend 5 meetings a week and get a paper signed. And mind you, like, this is 6 years since, you know, my son has been taken out of my life, and I'm in and out of my kids' lives. I'm wreaking havoc in that tornado the book talks about, and I don't even care. And I, you know, every time I get 2 seconds sober, I'm running around to everybody, going, like, I don't see what the problem is here. Like, I'm not drinking, all right? Like, leave me alone. Get off my back. And this is the kind of person I am, and I don't even think, you know, every time I get sober, I'm like, well, I gotta get my kids back, they're my kids, like, I gotta see my kids, first thing I ever do, and I don't realize the harm and the severe damage I'm causing these children. And by this time, my son is being raised by another woman, right? My second husband's remarried, and he calls this other woman mom, and I hate her more than anyone else on this planet. I hate the woman who gets up and does everything that I am incapable of doing. I hate the woman who takes care of him when he's sick. I hate the woman who takes him to school, who wakes up with him when he has nightmares. I said, I can't do it. And I'm so full of resentment and fear, and I don't even know it. I finally end up in the rooms of AA because I go to get a paper signed, and I of course, find a place that's convenient. You could smoke indoors, and there were cute boys there, and I did no work, and I didn't hear a word about the steps or a solution or the big book or anything. Like, I raised my hand, I told you about my day, I drank your coffee, I dated your men, and I got my paper signed, and I left. That was it. And when it was time to leave the, and you know, the thing about it is like, while I was doing this, I was getting stuff back on the outside. Like, I'm dressing up the outside yet again. I've got the job where I'm making money and I'm shoving it all in a stock drawer, saving it up because I can't open a bank account because that's how unmanageable my life still is. I'm getting visitation with my kids, you know, got a boyfriend probably, don't even remember at this point, but I always did. So, you know, I thought I was fine. There are 90 days are up. I have money for an apartment. I'm good to go. And I don't need AA anymore, and I don't need meetings, because I got stuff back. And 30 days after living in this apartment completely dry and not doing any meetings or any work or anything, I'm at my daughter's lacrosse game, and my six-year-old little boy looks at me, and he says, you know, you're not my real mom. Kim's my real mom because she takes care of me, and you just gave every day, and you just gave birth to me. And I'm telling you, like, it was like a knife in my heart. And it was the truest thing anybody had ever said to me in my entire life. And it was the most painful thing I'd ever heard in my entire life. And I did not have the ability to hear that kind of truth without some kind of solution, be it chemical or spiritual or whatever it is. And at that time, the only solution I knew was chemical. And needless to say, I was found overdosed on the floor of my apartment later on that night by my landlord. And what happened then was what our book talks about, a phenomenon of craving kicked off. I have one, and a year and a half later, I'm still drinking and I cannot stop. And it does not matter that I have eviction notices taped to my door, that I'm losing my job, that I have no money, that my parents are begging me to stop, that my beautiful daughter is like, please, Mom, don't do this anymore. And then I have a custody date coming up in court to lose full custody of my son forever. And I can't show up. I can't. I have no power anymore. And all that frothy emotional appeal just didn't. It couldn't stop me, and I didn't stop until I was physically separated from alcohol by law enforcement a year and a half later, and I did exactly the same thing all over again. I repeated the same cycle. I went to prison. I got out. Got sent to a recovery house. I went to meetings that did no work. Heard nothing about God or a solution. Complained about my day, and met a solution who lived at the recovery house down the street. Who was an aspiring rap artist, and moved in with him. And that was it. Like, that was it's so embarrassing. Yeah, and we moved in together, and like within the first week, we're both drinking and not telling each other, and then finally, like, we're drinking together, and that was the beginning of the end. That was the beginning of my last run, and all my other runs were long and drawn out, well over a year, and this one was a lot different because it was the shortest run of my life. And at the end of all my other runs, I was out of everything. Like, I had nothing, maybe a backpack full of clothes. That's it. But this, I had stuff. I had the roof over my head. I had the sick boyfriends. I had a car. I had money in my pocket, and I was dying inside. It was so painful, and I just wanted it to end. I just wanted it to end, and I didn't know how to end it. I didn't know. And I remember my last night. I remember grabbing the car keys. It was like three or four in the morning, and I grabbing the car keys off the nightstand in the room we were renting and crawling across the bedroom floor to sneak out of the room and get in my car. And I got on 95, and I was driving to Kensington, and for the first time in my life, I cried out to God. And like, I'll tell you, I've prayed my whole life. I'm not that person who didn't pray. But these are what my prayers were. They were, hey, God, can you do this for me, or fix this relationship, or get me out of jail, or, you know, get me well, or whatever it was. It was like, do something for me. And when God didn't follow through, I just thought he didn't exist or he didn't care about me. But for the first time in my life, I just screamed out. Because I screamed out to like a power I didn't even know if I believed in. And this was my prayer, and I'm really sorry if this offends anyone, but this was the prayer. It was like, dear God, just fucking kill me or stop me, please. And I screamed it, and I pounded on my steering wheel, Because for the first time in my life, I had the absolute most overwhelming desire to turn my car around and not drink, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't turn my car around no matter how badly I wanted to. And that for me was my true first step experience. When I, that overwhelming sense of powerlessness, I knew. And I knew that I needed something greater than me. And God showed up 12 hours later in the form of law enforcement, which he often does for me. I have 11 felonies, and I get locked up on this, like, summary retail theft, so I'm thinking, you know, this is going to be an in-and-out thing, and I have that moment of relief where I'm like, oh, God, thank God that's over, and this is how quickly, this is my window of brokenness and willingness that'll go right into pride, ego, and fear, so about an hour later, I'm being processed and put in a jail cell, and I'm like, wait, this is not how I wanted this to go down, like, can you send me to a detox, like, can we not do it this way, and they hand me a phone, and they say, call someone. And I picked up the phone and I tried to call everyone I could think of, and one by one, everybody hung up the phone on me. Everyone was done. And I couldn't even blame them. And it was just me alone in this cell, and I'm starting to get sick of the alcohol leaving my system, and I don't know, like, I went to jail, and I thought it was going to be a slap on the wrist, and I was wrong. About 10 months later, I stood in front of a judge, and she said, Ms. Ironside, I'm sentencing you to 1 to 3 years to the state correctional facility. And I went to state prison, and to me, the absolute empirical evidence that alcohol is not really my problem is the 18 months I spent completely dry, incarcerated, and I was a terrorist from inside the jail cell. I would call home and tell my family how they needed to help me and what they needed to do for me, and how they could be better people. And I would send these 4-page long apology letters home about, you know, I'm really sorry this happened, but maybe if you were better parents or siblings, you know, I wouldn't be here. And P.S., my commissary account is low. Please add funds. Like, put money on my phone account so I can call you and harass you. Like, that's essentially what I was doing, you know. Because that's it. Like, that's me and my sober skin without a solution. Like, it's all about me. It's all about what can you do for me. And I'm the victim, and I'm angry, and I'm afraid. And that's what I suffer from in my sober skin. And I just didn't know it, and I get released after 18 months, full of ideas about how Sarah's going to run her life, right? I'm going to fix things with the rapper ex-boyfriend, and we're going to work everything out. We're going to move into a couple's recovery house. Like, these were the thoughts I had in my head when I came home. And within a week, God smashed every single one of my ideas. And I was left in this recovery house. I hadn't had a drink in 18 months. I was as sober as I'm ever going to be. And I was never in more pain than I'd ever been in my entire life. And I couldn't understand why. Curled up in the fetal position on the floor of this recovery house saying, God, what is wrong with me? Why do I feel like this? I'm sober. It's not supposed to feel like this. And what happened is I went to AA. Now, again, not because it was my idea, because apparently, like, every time my light falls to the ground, that's where God sends me. And I walked up into the rooms. It was a Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the most amazing thing happened. I saw God in you, because I'd seen people in Alcoholics Anonymous for years, these happy, joyous, and free people, and I didn't believe it. I didn't believe you were either that happy, I didn't believe you drank like me, or... you know, you didn't suffer like I did, or you didn't understand, like, I just didn't believe it. But this time, God put these people in my path who I drank with, who were homeless, standing on the corners of Kensington, who couldn't get a second sober, and they were now sober and living free and lit up, and they were walking around with this big blue book, and they were talking about God and the steps, and they were helping people. And I asked this woman to help me, and she was my polar opposite physically in every way. Like, externally, we had nothing in common. 4'9", blonde cheerleader. But what she did, you know, her story held depth and weight. And she sat with me, and she knew how I felt in that moment. She knew how I felt in my, she knew I was crawling out of my skin. She explained to me about this allergy that I have, that once I have one, I can't stop. And that I have this mental obsession that will always bring me back to a drink. Always. It doesn't matter what the consequences look like. And that had been my experience. I could understand that. I could connect with that. And she talked to me about this spiritual malady, how I feel like this emptiness in my sober skin. And we started to have it. She started walking me through the steps. And she walked with me through these steps. And they were not Nothing about going through the steps was comfortable for me. It was one of the most uncomfortable things I'd ever experienced in my entire life, because I don't think I'd ever been honest with another human being in my entire existence. And, you know, I remember saying our third step prayer, and it was just like, you know, kneeling on the floor of a recovery house holding this girl's hand, and those girls behind just screaming about cigarettes and stuff. And I'm like, I don't understand, like, what this has to do with God. I didn't feel anything. I just didn't. But I was in a lot of pain. I remember that. And pain for me is the greatest motivator there is. And that is the same. That is true today. But what I did do, and I didn't even know I was making that decision at the time, I made the decision to go through with the rest of the steps. And because it says, like, this third step decision, it's a vital and crucial step, but it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by this strenuous effort to face and be rid of all this stuff that had been blocking me, right? And I didn't know until this, and what I did, she gave me a pen, you know, and said, write. You need to write. And I did. And I immediately started writing, and I wrote for days, and 27 pages later, I come back to her with this list, mostly resentments, because it was still everybody else's fault and I'm the victim, you know, and I sat with this woman for what I thought was my time to shine. I could sit there and tell her how everybody had wronged me. And that's not what happened. She sat with me for about 4.5 hours explaining to me these decisions based on self I had made that had placed me in these positions to be hurt time and time again. And even greater than that, and even greater than seeing, like, the truth of who I am, this selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate person, was this truth I got to see about who other people were. My mother got her own page. She was the first person on there. I resented my mother more than the men who did this to me. Like, I how could she do this to me? You know, I was so angry and by this. And by the time we got to that fourth column and we talked about all these horrible things that I had done to her, what really came out of this was the truth is that I had allowed this one decision my mother made when I was 15 years old, probably based on her own fear, one decision she made, and I allowed it to blind me to this amazing human being who was my mother, this woman who showed up in every prison cell, in every rehab, who invited me to family functions when nobody wanted me there, showed up for everything. And that's what my resentments do. They blind me to who people truly are. And I saw my mother for the first time. And I walked out of that fifth step not feeling like I could look the world in the eye. That wasn't my experience. I felt horrible. I saw in black and white the truth of who Sarah really is. And I didn't feel better. I felt worse. And I'm grateful I felt worse, because I don't know if I would have been as motivated to go through with the rest of the steps. And you know, 6 and 7, I love how that's just like two paragraphs in the big book, and it's like two of the biggest steps in my life today. When I first came into the rooms, it was just like, yeah, sure, I was completely broken. Like, you can have all of me. I'm clinging to nothing. You know, that's different today, you know. I didn't even realize that how much I end up holding on to the longer I stay sober, the longer my, you know, my ego has a chance to rebuild and all this other stuff. And it talks in our 12 and 12 about how there's really nothing all that spiritual about asking God to take the stuff from us that's causing its consequences. Like, God, yeah, I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, I'm a thief, all this stuff, and it causes me problems in my life. Please take all that. But, you know, the longer I stay sober, I find things I want to pick and choose and I want to hold on to. And what I've been finding about these two small but extremely powerful paragraphs in the big book is that, for me, that's where the most spiritual growth comes from, because that's where I really get to look at me and really get to, you know, have the humility to bring these things to God and have Him mold me into the person He wants me to be. And thank God I had that humility before I went out and I made these amends, because my amends for the most part were beautiful. And that's really where I felt for the first time the true presence of my Creator. That nearness of God that the promises talk about. My mother was one of my first amends. And I remember I wrote, like, I had this whole thing scripted out, and my sponsor was like, I would call my sponsor. I'm like, I said, I'm terrified. And she said, why don't you just throw the script out and pray? And that's what I did. And when I prayed, God did for me. He spoke through me, and what came out of my mouth was the absolute truth about how I blamed her for everything, about the hell I had put her through, about the fear that I had caused her and all this pain that I had caused her. And she listened to everything I had to say. And you know, she really didn't have anything to add at that time when I asked her if I'd left anything out. But when I said, is there anything I can do to make this right? She said, I need you to be a living example to your brother. And my brother still suffers from this disease, and he is still active in his drinking. And I've been given the honor to try to fulfill this immense to my mother by being a living big book for my brother, because he may never be able to open that book as long as he, or be willing to open that book as long as he lives. But I get to carry these principles and into my actions, and I don't hit him over the head with it. And I get to help my family, help my brother. And that's what you guys gave me, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, and all. And since that amends with my mother, like the resentment's been completely, it's been gone, and I have a beautiful relationship with her today, which is an absolute miracle. And, I don't know, 10, 11, and 12, I was immediately like thrown into, and I practiced them to the best of my ability. You know, mostly addressing my resentments, because I'm real, you know, that's really easy to do, but not really getting into the nuances of like the deeper level fears and things like that. But I was sponsoring women very early on. I'm not here to tell anybody how they should go through their steps, but like 35 days after starting the steps, I was sponsoring other women. And like I said in the beginning, in the beginning, it was like a life-saving, like I was doing it because I just didn't want to drink anymore, and I was terrified, and I really felt I had nothing to offer anybody else. I lived in a recovery house. I worked at it for a cleaning company, and I had a 350-pound state parole officer and a curfew. So I was like, I don't really know what I have to offer anybody. And she just said, like, it has nothing to do with you. Pray, open the book, share your experience, and read. And that's what I did. And I don't know. And I'm so grateful. I am grateful that I had my experience, because, you know, my good friend Rick always says, like, we do the work for when we need it, because these trials and low spots, they're coming. And coming up on 4 years sober, they came in a really big way. So I'll start with saying that this time around, I also got in a relationship, but this time was I thought was different, because I thought God was in this relationship. And, because I waited a whole 9 months to move in with him and all this other good stuff, you know. I was wrong. So yeah, we moved in together, and he picked up, and he couldn't stop drinking. And, I don't know, like, something happened, like there was a disconnect with God. It was like I could turn my will and my life over to the power of God as I understand him for me. But I became totally agnostic when it came to him. And I was practicing this this very impartial 10th step, because it says when these crop up, when fear, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment crop up, you know, I would talk about my resentment. Hell, I'll post on Facebook about my resentment. I'll tell everyone how resentful I am. But where was I? I wasn't talking about my fear. I wasn't talking about the fear that this man was going to die in bed next to me, or he was going to die on the street if I kicked him out, because I kind of deluded myself into thinking I had that kind of power, even though I knew better. That fear of what other people in Alcoholics Anonymous were going to think about me, because I had an active alcoholic living in my home and I didn't have the power to throw him out. That dishonesty that started when I came in the rooms, because I was afraid of what you thought of me. And when people would ask me, how are things at home? And I said, everything's fine. One of the biggest lies I ever told in the rooms of AA was, everything's fine. And the selfishness, and I didn't even really know how selfish I was until years later, until after this ended, that I didn't want him to be okay for him. I wanted him to be okay for me. I wanted to fix him so my life would look a certain way. I denied him. I was denying him his own pain and his own experience. And I was able to reach that beautiful place of surrender, that beautiful place of brokenness. And I was keeping that from him by constantly cushioning his blows, trying to manage his life for him. I'll get you a sponsor. I'll get you a recovery house, doing all this stuff. And that's what I did. And I was doing that for almost a year when I got home. And during this period of time, so I had made an amends to my sister pretty early on, and it was one of the best amends that I had ever made. My sister and I had a very difficult relationship. We could never get along, and it was one of those amends where every argument we had, it was like fuse of longstanding. It just fell away. It was gone. And she admitted her faults to me, and she was in a really dark place. She was severely anorexic, and she had all these same fears and disconnect, and she felt completely alone, and she was full of shame, and she couldn't talk to anybody in this world. And what AA gave me, and the amends process gave me, was the ability to connect with my sister in a way nobody else could. Not her husband, not her children, not my parents, nobody. And it was the greatest gift, one of the greatest gifts I've been given in my sobriety, because I was able to have a year and a half friendship with my sister before my mom called me 5:30 in the morning and told me my sister was dead. And you know, our promises talk about intuitively knowing how to handle situations, which used to baffle us. I intuitively knew that this had nothing to do with me, that I needed to show up and help my parents bury their daughter, and that I needed to show up and help her children bury their mother. And I got, and I say this, and I didn't see this at the time, it's again one of those things I only see in hindsight, is that I got the honor and privilege of being able to stand next to my mother when she saw her daughter in the casket for the first time. I got to be able to be there for her, to comfort her. It was God situated me to be there, and the only reason I was able to do that is because of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 steps. I got to show up for my family, and I got to be in the moment, and I got to find out what true spirituality is. It doesn't have anything to do with beautiful quotes or a sunset or any of that. It has to do with, even in the most painful thing you could possibly imagine, knowing that God is in the center of everything and that somehow, some way, things are going to be okay. And I went home grieving my sister, and I'm still living in this insane situation, right? And all of a sudden, like, I can't take it anymore, and I'm starting to suffer internally, and it's, I swear, the only thing that saved me from thinking about a drink was I was in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was running to AA, and I was sponsoring women, but I was hiding out in AA because I wasn't going home to face what was happening there. I was using newcomers to avoid my life, and I wasn't fully practicing these principles in all my affairs. And I started doing what our six-step asks to do, which is ask for the willingness. And I started asking for the willingness, please give me the willingness to stop clinging to this relationship over and over and over again. And then a couple weeks later, this man called me from whatever treatment center he was in that week, and God did for me what I could not do for myself. He spoke through me, and I said the words without even forming them with my mouth. They came out of me. You're not coming home. And he did not come home. He never came home. And God did that. That wasn't me. And what happened when he left is my life started to get better. I started working with another sponsor, and, I ended up having to do a whole other inventory that was all the fear that I had allowed to pile up. And I walked away from that inventory with those promises immediately. Like, I felt like a million pound weight had been lifted off of me. And I remember at the end of this woman had asked me, she said, like, what other books have you been reading? And I'm basically like, I don't know, like the big book and maybe some novel. And she was like, it might be time to like start reading some other spiritual stuff and doing some other things to connect with God. And, because I didn't even realize this as I went for several years in my sobriety, ignoring that little paragraph in chapter 11 that says, in step 11 that says, seek to see where religious people are right and continue to read other books. You know, I was still holding on to old ideas and prejudices, and I didn't even know it. You know, here's a spoiler alert. If you didn't already know, there's really nothing spiritual about judging other people's spiritual belief systems. And that's what I was doing. And I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was like, oh my God, that's what you believe in? Like, and you know, that's sort of intellectual superiority that I was carrying around, and I didn't even realize it. And I started reading these other books, and I started, doing other forms of meditation and having a whole new experience with God. And that experience continues to grow and change. And it's become such a beautiful thing, because I remember reading this line in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, but the book said something like, if your sole outer purpose is helping other people, then you're constantly dependent on other people to be less fortunate than you are. And it's something about that line hit me like a knife in the gut. It was just like I had been running to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, seeking relief in a human power. And I'm not saying there's a right, wrong way to do this. For me, if I don't do the 11 steps prior to the 12th step, then I have nothing to transmit, and I'm just using you to make me feel better. And it was amazing, because I went through this period of time when I wasn't really doing the work prior to step 12, where I would start getting annoyed when these women would call me and losing that joy that I had. But after I started having this whole new experience, that joy and that love for AA came back with a vengeance, and it has not gone away since. And what my life looks like today is absolutely beyond description. Like, I cannot describe the gratitude I have for my life today and what an amazing life I have. And that's not to say that on any given day I can't wake up like an insane person, because what I get is a daily reprieve. And on any day I want to check Facebook before I get on my knees and talk to God, there's a problem. But on most days, like when I do the things that, I take these disciplines that are outlined in the book and I apply them to my life looks beautiful. My life is incredible. So I have 11 felonies and I get to work in a law firm today. Right? Yeah. I was sworn in as a notary public for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the same courthouse where I was sentenced to state prison. that's not me. Like, that's God. Like, there's really no other explanation for that. And they know. It's not a secret. The Department of State had to clear me, so they know. But it doesn't matter because they see the person God made me. They're not judging me based on who I used to be. And I have a beautiful 3-bedroom house that I get to share with my best friend and now 6 cats. You know, I have a whole bank account and, you know, a nice credit score and a new car because I actually made financial amends and all that stuff's great. All that could be gone tomorrow. I have gifts that are so much greater than that. I have a peace of mind when I go home to that house that I can just sit in that house and not turn on every device to try to drown out my thoughts. I go to bed at night and I fall asleep knowing I didn't harm someone. And if I did, I know I can get up tomorrow and I can make that right. I have relationships with people that I never believed that I would have in a million years. I have friendships and true love for other people. I have relationships with my sisters, my nieces and my nephews, with my mother who calls me constantly now. Like, and it's crazy that my family calls me to ask me what to do about a certain situation because this is what the 12 steps do. They don't just help us. They help our families heal. They see these principles working in my life, and they come to me with things that they never would have come to me before in a million years. And that's a gift of this program. It's something I can't even believe is my life today. And my daughter is my best friend. My daughter's my best friend, and by all rights, she should hate my guts, and she doesn't. She got a living amend. She didn't want to hear a declaration. She wanted to see action, and AA gave her mother back, and more so than she's ever had in her entire life. We take road trips all up and down the East Coast. We ran Broad Street last year, and we're going to run again this year. And we talk every single day. And that's the gift I get from AA. And I'm going to end with this. I have a son who I haven't seen in coming up on 13 years now. And when I first came home and I started going through my steps, I made an approach to his parents to make an amends, and they were not willing to hear it. I wrote them a letter. And they did not respond. A year later, I tried again, and they did not respond. And I'm so grateful that I have a program of God Reliance versus Human Reliance. And that, because I can go to 30 different people in the rooms, and I can hear 30 different opinions of what I should do. And I was getting 20 different opinions from my family members about what I should do. Like, you never had your rights stripped, so you do have rights, and you should get a lawyer and do all these things. And instead, I did what our book tells us to do, which is ask God for an intuitive thought or decision, and I did. And it was coming up, it was like 3 years ago, it was right around Easter. I was in a lot of pain, and I was really missing my son, and I kept asking God, because I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't even know what my son looked like. And I kept asking God, please show me what to do here. I miss my son. Please show me what to do. And God showed up the way he always does. It was Good Friday on Easter weekend. I was up at 10:30 at night, and I typed my son's name in Instagram, and he had a girlfriend who made a joke Instagram account, and I saw my son's face for the first time in a decade. And he is beautiful, and he is loved, and he is happy. And I knew that right now, in this moment, I don't need to do anything. That God's got this, and it's going to be okay. And that's something from something so much greater than me. Because I always had stipulations on what the external part of my life needed to look like in order for me to maintain sobriety. I always had this idea of what I could and could not stay sober through, right? If I can't get and stay sober if I lose this job. I can't get and stay sober if somebody I love dies. I can't get and stay sober if I don't get my kids back. But God has completely disproven all of that. It says in chapter 7, let no alcoholic say he cannot fully recover unless he has his family back. It simply isn't true. I have fully recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I haven't thought about a drink or a drug for longer than I can remember. I have the most amazing life today. I have peace. I have serenity. I have joy in my heart today. And most of all, I have absolute gratitude for the program that gave me that, the 12 steps, and everyone here. That's all I have. Thanks.